And we are going to Numbers, but I would imagine you've turned in your Bible to Numbers. But if you haven't, before you turn to Numbers, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And if you have turned to Numbers, put a bookmark in there or your finger and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It's a good starting point for getting a bird's eye view of the book of Numbers, because Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 to 13, that the book of Numbers was written not only for Moses' generation, but for our generation today. And follow along as I read Numbers 10, 1 to 13. Paul says, "For I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers," referring to the Jewish people, in particular here, the generation under Moses, "were all under the cloud." That would be the cloud of the Shekinah glory that led them from Egypt to Canaan and passed through the sea, which would be the Red Sea. "All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food." That would be manna. "All ate the same spiritual drink," the water that came out of the rock. "For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." So Paul says that that historical account, there was a real rock and there was real water, but that also is a picture of the coming of Christ. Verse 5, "Nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as an example for us." Paul's writing in his day, a long time after these events occurred, and the same principle applies to us 2,000 years after Paul wrote. "Examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." So there are lessons in Numbers to give us an example of why we should not desire evil. Verse 7, "Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." That's in the context of the golden calf. "We must not indulge in sexual immorality, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. These things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." But that great passage, over and over and over again, points out lessons for us from what happened in the book of Numbers. That what happened to Israel in this book are examples and lessons to us. Therefore, it is a good thing for us to know what's in the book of Numbers. Now, the book of Numbers has, when you stop and think about it, kind of a strange name. Yes, I know there are a lot of numbers in the book of Numbers, but that's just a small portion of the book. The name that we have for this book, Numbers, comes from, like the same thing we saw with Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, that the name comes from the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament called the Septuagint. And the word in Greek is a word that you know. Even if you've never studied Greek, it's arithmoi or arithmetic, A-R-I-T-H-O-M-I. And we get our word arithmetic from it. Now, the reason it's called the book of Numbers isn't just simply because there's a lot of numbers, but it's what those numbers represent. Those numbers were two numberings, two censuses that were taken of the Jewish people for some very important reasons. And because those two censuses or numberings are prominent in the book, it got the name Numbers. But don't be misled if you've not read the book into thinking that the book is nothing but numbers. It is a whole lot more than that. Probably a better name for it, although we'll give up on us renaming the book. I mean, it's stuck there, and it has been for 2,000 years, so we're not going to succeed. But if we were going to come up with a better name for it, it would probably be the Book of Murmurings, or the Book of Grumbling, or the Book of Complaining, because that happens over and over and over again in the book as the Jewish people are being led by Moses. They grumble, they complain. As a result, God disciplines them and so on. And they're wandering in the wilderness. And one of the reasons they are wandering is going to take them over 40 years to go from Egypt to Canaan, and shouldn't have done that. Should have just taken weeks or months. But it took over 40 years because of the very wandering around was a judgment, as we'll see, on them because of their grumbling and complaining. The Hebrew Bible has a much better title, I think, to it. In Hebrew, it's a word that means in the wilderness, and that's what this is. It's the story of Israel in the wilderness, and they happen to be wandering in that wilderness as part of the judgment. Now, the wilderness, you say, but I thought it was a desert. To us, we usually think of a wilderness as being very wooded, heavy brush cover, that kind of thing. But it is desert wilderness. It's wilderness in the sense that it's not a settled area, and there's wild things there and that kind of thing. The period covered by the book is 38 years in Israel's history. It covers 38 years and 36 chapters. So obviously, it's not a detailed account of everything that happened to Israel, but the important things are covered. Someone has written, in Genesis, God elected a people. In Exodus, he redeemed them. In Leviticus, he sanctified them. In Numbers, he directed them. The author is Moses, and we won't spend much time on that. The notes from looking at Genesis apply here, and same principle in Exodus and Leviticus is also in Numbers. But to mention that there are more than 80 claims in the book that the Lord spoke to Moses. In fact, that's how the book starts in verse 1, is that God spoke to Moses. 80 times throughout the book that is stated. And it's out of those 80 times of God speaking to Moses that Moses wrote the book. Moses wrote detailed records, by the way, as an eyewitness. We know that because of Numbers chapter 33, which I will look up, and you're welcome to if you care to. Numbers 33, verse 2. Numbers 33, verse 2. Moses wrote down their starting places, stage by stage, by command of the Lord, and these are their stages according to their starting places. And this chapter is a listing of all these staging places and where they camped and then left from, and so on. So that tells us that Moses kept a lot of written records. He was a very educated man because of the education that he had as a boy in Egypt, and certainly knew how to read and write and put that into practice. The theme of the book is the consequence of disbelief and disobedience to the Holy God. And that certainly comes out from beginning to end of this book, the consequence of disbelief and disobedience to the Holy God. Before we look at the book, we do want to take note of the fact, as we did in Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus, that Christ is in Numbers. And remember that Jesus in Luke 24 on the road to Emmaus, took those disciples through the Old Testament, Genesis to Malachi, showing them things that referred to him. He probably pointed out some of these things in Numbers. For instance, there's the bronze serpent in chapter 21, verses 4 to 9. Jesus refers to that himself in John chapter 3, verse 14, in the conversation with Nicodemus. And he said, in the same way that Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That was a statement referring to his future crucifixion. Refers to an incident in the wilderness here. He uses this account of what happened, that there was, because of the Israel's sin, God brought a judgment of poisonous snakes that came into the camp. Everyone that was bitten by those snakes either died or became very sick. And Moses didn't know what to do. And God said, take some bronze and mold a snake and then put it on a pole. And everyone who is sick, who simply looks at the snake, is going to be healed. And that was done. And of course, it seems like kind of a silly thing to do, but God knew what he was doing, and he put in there a picture of, for us who have been bitten by sin and have a fatal wound because of sin, that if we look to Christ on the pole, on the cross, that we will be healed of sin, not by human works, but by faith, by looking at Christ. Great, great picture of Christ, which we don't have to say, well, we're going to make this up, because Christ himself said it's a picture of him. The rock that quenches the thirst of the multitudes is a type of Christ, 1 Corinthians 10:4, in the passage that we began. The daily manna pictures the bread of life, who later comes down from heaven, John 6:31-33. That earthly food that God miraculously brought to them every day when they got up, the manna was out there waiting for them to gather it, called heavenly bread, as it were. Jesus in John 6 applies that to himself. I am the bread of life come from heaven. I am what that manna was looking ahead towards. Balaam prophesied the rulership of Christ. I hope we'll have some time tonight to talk about Balaam. It's a fascinating incident in the book of Numbers. But Balaam, this heathen astrologer, winds up speaking the words of God, including a prophecy of Messiah that's going to be involved. We get involved with it every Christmas time when we talk about the Magi. All that's connected here in Numbers. The guidance and presence of Christ is seen in the pillar of the cloud and the fire that led them. The sinner's refuge in Christ may be seen in the six cities of refuge. I don't think we'll have time to talk about the cities of refuge when we get to that part of the outline. But God ordained to the Jewish people that, knowing that there would be times when people would be unintentionally killed, accidents happen, particularly in a society like theirs, where the people are dealing with agriculture and animals and axes and you name it, there's going to be accidents and people will be killed. And it will be a reaction of people when their relative is killed to go and get revenge. And God, of course, says, don't get revenge. But he establishes these cities of refuge where if they will go, if this person who's possibly going to be harmed by relatives of someone who's been killed, they can go to the city of refuge and be unharmed. And then the case is investigated and so on. Those cities of refuge are a picture of Christ. He is our refuge that we flee to and so on. So you get the picture. Well, we will walk through the book of Numbers by using an outline from the Daily Walk. And it's a good outline. It has the first part is walking, chapters 1 to 12, and then wandering, chapters 13 to 36. So two major parts of the book. First of all, the walking, chapters 1 to 12. And Numbers picks up where Exodus leaves off, because Leviticus didn't continue the historical story. Leviticus was involved with giving us God's laws and procedures and so on. So they're at Mount Sinai, and they're camped there quite a long time. And then they leave, and that is continued in the book of Numbers. And so first of all, we have from Sinai, that is from Mount Sinai, there's also the desert of Sinai, but we're talking about Mount Sinai, from Mount Sinai to Kadesh. Kadesh is a very important place in Israel's history, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And that is preparation for entering into the land. Now, if you turn the page, you'll see that I gave you a map. This map, I think, is an excellent map showing the Exodus, the route of the Exodus, and so on. It's from the Daily Walk magazine also. But if you look at the map over on the left, you see they left Egypt, the land of Goshen, and they come down south to Mount Sinai. And that's where the book of Numbers begins. And then they're heading towards Canaan, so they're heading north. And then you'll see it just kind of goes in circles there. And that's where they wander for 40 years. And finally, then they leave that and they go up on the east side of the Dead Sea, and they come to the Jordan River to cross over. And on this map, you have some boxes there that point out where different things happened. It's a very, very good map. So it's a good one for referring to in the account of Numbers. Well, turning back to the previous page, page 13, we have, first of all, A, the people counted and encamped. You know, the New Testament says that God is a God of order and wants things done decently and in order, just like the military. You know, the epitome to us of orderliness is the military. You march in sync, and you do your rifle drill in sync, and you have a unit that's here in order and a unit here that's in order. God is a God of order, and he doesn't want these people just going through the wilderness. After all, it's a couple of million people, just as a mob. It's not going to work. So he very precisely gives instructions both for how they are to be arranged when they are camped, when they are stationary, and then the order in which they are to march out when God says, leave here and go somewhere else. But to get ready for that, God calls for a census. And this is part of the numbering of why the book is called the Book of Numbers. Now, the purpose of the census, to find out exactly how many Jewish people we have, is to, for a couple of reasons. First of all, to demonstrate the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham concerning the number of descendants he's going to have. Because 400 years earlier, Abraham's descendants numbered 70 who entered into the promised land. Now, 400 years later, wow, it's 2 million or so. And it's just a testimony that God's promise is being fulfilled of the huge number of descendants that Abraham is going to have. Also, the precise purpose for this census is to know how many fighting men they have, because there's going to be some battles when they come to the land. Now, of course, they don't know at this point that none of these fighting men are going to fight in the land of Canaan, but the expectation was that they were. But the sin of unbelief and grumbling and complaining is going to intervene, and it's going to wind up being another generation. But they want to know how many fighting men they have. So they count the number of the men, over 20, who could fight, and it numbers 603,550 men between the ages of 20 to 60. Now, it's from that number that we calculate that there were over 2 million, because then you've got to count the women. And then you have to count the males under 20 and over 60, and those who were handicapped and couldn't fight, and all the children, and so on. And so you calculate that, and you come up with a couple of million people. Now, in chapters 3 and 4, the Levites are counted twice, and there's a reason for that. First of all, every male Levite over 1 month old is counted, because the male Levites took the place of the firstborn males of the other tribes. You see, God had said that the firstborn belonged to him. Firstborn of the animals and the firstborn of families. And it's tied in with the whole thing of Passover, with the firstborn and so on. Well, God then said, in place of every family's firstborn son being given to God for serving God in whatever way, we're going to substitute all the Levite men. So that's why in chapters 3 and 4 there is a numbering of the Levite men to find out how many they are. And it turns out it's almost exactly the same number as all the men of the rest of the tribes, although it's 273 men short. In other words, there's 273 men of the 11 tribes combined, more than the men of the tribe of Levi. So God says, for those extra men, they are going to be redeemed by paying 5 shekels of silver for each one, and so on. There's another reason for these two censuses, and that is, transporting the tabernacle takes some muscles. And so they want to see, are there enough able-bodied men among the Levites? Because only Levites can carry the holy instruments of the tabernacle. So all of that is why there are two censuses of the Levites. Then it goes into a description of the placement of the camps in reference to the tabernacle. That is, in the camp that they would build or set up everywhere they went, there would be, in the central spot in the camp, would be the tabernacle. And the tribes would be in positions around the four sides of the tabernacle. But the heart of it is going to be the presence of God and where the sacrifices are made and so on. So then, in this chapter, God is a God of order, and he says, which tribes are to be to the east and to the north and to the west and to the south? And in the last few weeks, I've heard twice some comment about what it appears when you have all 12 tribes put in that position. Someone from our church was in another church a few weeks ago, and the pastor was preaching through Numbers. And he was in this passage, and he had a drawing, and I think he projected it. And so you've got the tribes here, and tribes here, and tribes there, and tribes there. It says, you know, isn't it interesting when God looked down that he saw the form of a cross? And then, Harry, you brought that up a few weeks ago, that you had read somewhere about that. Okay. Well, I'm not convinced. Because I didn't have time to do a lot of research on it, but I did see several different diagrams of the placing of the tribes. And some of them sure enough, looking down, it is in the shape of a cross, but not all of them, such as this one, is not in the shape of a cross. So in other words, I don't think the instructions are clear enough that we can say dogmatically that they were there in the shape of a cross. So sorry to...
Mm-hmm. And when you total those numbers, if you make a certain number of divisions per, whatever, 100 or 1,000, that's how they came up with that number.
No, this does not take into account the numbers.
Oh.
And I did not run into any reference to that, so I'm not sure where that comes from. So. Anyway, but the point is, yep, that God is a God of order in what he's doing. Okay. Going on to, oh, by the way, it is figured out that the area of the camp, it would take up 12 square miles. And I sat at my desk and I thought, okay, 12 square miles. I'm guessing, say, from Tustin to Mission Viejo, would you think that's about 12 miles? I'm guessing something like that. Maybe more. Tustin to Lake Forest, maybe. And then from here to the ocean. I'm just kind of thinking those terms and might give you an idea of this large. I mean, and they didn't have motorized vehicles to go from one end to the other. I mean, this is a large, large encampment. Okay, then we have B, the people cleansed. And this is not because they are physically dirty. They need to take a bath in that sense. But it's the issue of the ceremonial uncleanness that was such a big thing in the book of Leviticus. And that is such a big thing in the law because God is communicating in the picture book. The law is like a picture book, like a child that can't read yet has a picture book that tells him the story. And God gave Israel a picture book in the law. And all of these rules and regulations about ceremonial uncleanliness is to get across a point about spiritual uncleanliness, spiritual pollution in the spirit, in the soul. And so there are certain issues that have to be dealt with here with the people of this ceremonial uncleanness to make sure they're ready to follow God when they leave Mount Sinai. In chapter 6, involved in this are the rules of the Nazarites. Most everyone has heard about the Nazarites, but almost everyone mixes them up with the Nazarenes. And that's two absolutely different things. The Nazarenes, Jesus was a Nazarene. Nazarenes were people that were from the town of Nazareth. And that was part of the humiliation of Christ when here he's God in all of his glory and he comes and he grows up in a town where people say, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Is there any good Nazarene out there? And Jesus is. But that's not a Nazarite. Nazarites, this was something that God gave to Israel where he said when a person wants to just especially give thanks to God and praise God for something special, they can take a Nazarite vow. You could take it for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, that kind of thing. And certain extra rules of this spiritual cleanliness, ritual cleanliness, was in effect for a Nazarite. During this time where they took this vow, they were not to drink any wine or grape juice, anything from grapes. They were not to touch a dead body. And they were not to cut their hair. Then at the end of the time of the vow, they would cut their hair and they would bring it as an offering to the Lord. The Apostle Paul did that in the New Testament. There's a little reference to that in the book of Acts. There are three lifetime Nazarites mentioned in the Bible, and that also was a provision that a parent, before the child was born, could dedicate them for their entire life to the Lord. And their whole life would be lived with a Nazarite vow. The first one we meet in the Old Testament is who? Samson. And guess what? Samson broke every one of those Nazarite vows. That's part of what makes his story interesting. When you realize the Nazarite vows, and then you see him going and the cutting of the hair and touching of the body of the lion and so on, and he broke every one of those. The next one in chronological order is Samuel, and Hannah was not able to have children, you remember, and she promised God that if she had a child, she would dedicate him to the Lord. Apparently, that was in the sense of a Nazarite vow, as well as working in the temple with Eli. The third one appears to be John the Baptist. From what we can tell about John the Baptist, it doesn't use the word Nazarite, but it appears that Elizabeth and Zacharias had set him apart as a Nazarite for his life. And so those instructions are part of this section on the cleansing. Well, turning the page past the map to page 14, we have C, the people complaining in chapters 9 to 12. First of all, we have to remember what's going on. At the beginning here, we're having the Passover. This is the second Passover. This is 1 year after the Exodus, after the original Passover. So this is the first commemoration of the Passover in chapter 9. And then they depart Sinai. Now, they were at Sinai for over a year. Can you imagine the emotions? I mean, have you ever been on a journey, fairly lengthy journey, and near the beginning of the journey, you get stuck somewhere, and you wind up staying and staying and staying, but you're anxious to get going. And finally the day comes when you leave and there's excitement and anticipation of what's ahead and you're looking forward to it and so on. And I have to imagine that all the Jewish people had those emotions. But it didn't take long, in fact just days, before they began to complain. Now I put a list here of the times and numbers where they complain. And this goes beyond chapters 9 to 12, but just to put them all in one spot. Chapter 11, verse 1, they're complaining about their misfortunes. And as a result of the judgment of God, thousands died when God sent a plague of fire. Chapter 11, verse 4, they complain about the lack of meat. Because for over a year now, they've had plenty to eat, plenty of nourishment, manna. That's this one food gave them every vitamin and mineral that they needed, and it kept them strong and healthy. But they want variety. Sound familiar? And God did put within us that desire for variety. And of course, in the perfect state in the Garden of Eden, you had all that variety of fruit and vegetable, and God said, it's all yours, except for one for you to take. But now, the human nature being what it is, they wanted a variety, and they complained. And God sent quail in such numbers that they were able just to reach up and grab them as they were flying over so low. But then also as part of the judgment of their grumbling, he sent a plague that killed many. Then in chapter 14, verses 1 to 4, they're complaining about being stuck in the wilderness and facing giants in the promised land. And they want to return to Egypt. This happens at this place called Kadesh Barnea. They get there and they're only like 50 miles away from the border of the promised land. And they send 12 spies into the land. And the spies come back and say, oh my goodness, we've got a problem. Oh, it's a great land of milk and honey, and they brought back these huge grapes and so on. But they said there's giants in the land. And I think it becomes obvious that they exaggerate about the giants. And they say, oh, there's giants, and well, we're just never going to be able to do it. 10 of the spies say that, but 2 don't, Joshua and Caleb. But the nation follows along with the other 10. And they begin to complain because God brought the first, they disbelieve. They don't trust God that he can conquer the land through them. And then God says, okay, because of that, you're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Then they begin to complain about that and so on. Then chapter 16, verse 3, they grumble and complain about Moses and Aaron's authority and leadership. And there's kind of a rebellion that comes up with Korah and Dathan and Abiram. And these 3 men and their families and friends are swallowed by the earth. Very dramatic moment. Looks good in movies like the Ten Commandments. Very dramatic moment. And then on top of that, fire burned 250 other men that rebelled. Then in chapter 16, verse 41, Moses and Aaron caused the deaths of Korah. They're complaining, saying Moses and Aaron caused the deaths of Korah and his conspirators. So they're complaining that Moses caused this that happened, and God sends a plague that kills many. Chapter 20, verse 3, they're complaining about the lack of water. And in this time, Moses sins along with the people. And for this, he is barred from entering into the promised land. But by the way, he will come back later. He did get to come into the land later in the time of Christ at the Mount of Transfiguration. Remember, Jesus is there with Peter, James, and John, and Moses and Elijah are there. So he did eventually make it into the land. Chapter 21, verse 5, they complain that God and Moses brought them into the wilderness. And that's when God sent the poisonous snakes, which killed many and injured others. And the remedy was that brass snake put on the pole. All they had to do was to look and live. That brings us to the second division, which is the wandering in the wilderness, chapters 13 to 36. First of all, we have from Kadesh to Kadesh. That is, entering into the land is postponed. So they started at Kadesh, and they wandered for 40 years and came back to Kadesh. And it's only 50 miles from Beersheba, the southernmost part of the promised land. Okay, first of all, the 12 spies and death in the wilderness, verses 14 to 16. Chapter 14... Chapter 14:22 makes a specific mention. It says none of the men, this is in the whole issue of the 12 spies and so on, none of the men who have seen my glory and my signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not obeyed my voice. So he refers to 10 times there. I have written these down. I apologize. I didn't put them in your notes so that you wouldn't have to write so much. But lacking faith at the crossing of the Red Sea is the first one. That's in Exodus 14. So lacking faith at the crossing of the Red Sea. Complaining over bitter waters at Marah is Exodus 15. Complaining in the wilderness of sin, Exodus 16. And that wilderness of sin, that has nothing to do with our word sin. That's the Hebrew name, sin or seen. Collecting more than the daily quota of manna in Exodus 16. Disobeyed God there. Collecting manna on the Sabbath in Exodus 16. Disobeyed God there. Complaining over lack of water at Rephidim. Exodus 17, committing idolatry with a golden calf, Exodus 32, complaining at Taberah, Numbers 11, More complaining over the lack of delicious food in Numbers 11. Failing to trust God and enter the promised land, Numbers 14. So these 10 different occasions where they tested God and sinned against God in this wilderness march. That brings us to Aaron and the Levites in the wilderness in chapters 17 to 20. First of all, in chapter 17, we have an incident with Aaron's rod that budded. That's going to be referred to numerous times in the Old Testament. And in fact, his rod that budded is going to be part of the pieces of memorabilia that are put into the Ark of the Covenant. And what this was about, there was this rebellion of Korah against Moses' leadership. And in the aftermath of that, God wanted to make sure that all 12 tribes realized that Moses was God's appointed spokesman. So he said, I want the leader of each tribe to come to the tabernacle and bring one rod for each of the tribes. Now, a rod would have been a branch from a tree that then the smaller branches were cut off and so on, and you had a pretty good size rod. So they were all brought to the tabernacle. Well, the next morning, they come and they look, and one of those rods had budded and even borne fruit just overnight. And this is a dead piece of wood because it's not connected to a tree anymore. And so it was miraculous. It was God's doing. It happened to be Aaron's rod that budded. And that was a lesson to the Jewish people of Aaron and Moses were God's appointed leaders. So that happens in chapter 17. Chapter 18, there's the duties and privileges of the priests. Then in chapter 19, some things happen. Of course, when we get to chapter 19, there have been 38 and a half years have gone by since they left Egypt. 1.2 million people have died in the wilderness. And when you look at that map, just in pretty much in a small area of the wilderness, 1.2 million people. So in other words, people were dying every day. And every day they were coming in contact with dead bodies. Well, you remember from the purification rules of Leviticus that you touch a dead body and you are ceremonially defiled. Ceremonially unclean because you have touched death, and death is a result of sin. And this is all part of the package of trying to communicate to them about the contamination of sin. But because of the rules that God has set, we have a whole lot of people who are ceremonially defiled. So God gives Moses some additional procedures for cleansing people from ceremonial defilement. And it involves taking something interesting, taking a red heifer. Is that ringing a bell? Some of you have heard some things about a red heifer. And they would take a red heifer and they would burn it, and the ashes would be mixed with water and sprinkled on the person who has been defiled, particularly by coming in contact with a dead body. And that was a ceremony for cleansing them. Those ashes lasted a long time. When they finally ran out of them, they then would get another red heifer and burn that and have some more ashes that would last a long time. The Jewish Mishnah, which is the oral law, the Jewish people certainly have the written law of the Old Testament, but they also have been very involved in what they call the oral law. They say it wasn't written down like the Torah, but they say God gave it And it is inspired by God, and it was passed down from generation to generation, finally put in written form some years after the time of Christ, shortly after the time of Christ. Well, in the Mishnah, you have a whole lot about the Jewish traditions and so on. Well, the Mishnah added all kinds of regulations about this whole thing about the red heifer. For instance, it said, and by red, obviously, we're not talking about a bright red where someone has taken some paint and painted it. I mean, this is a reddish-colored heifer, which, you know, they're out there. But the Mishnah just went into all kinds of things. There could not even be two black hairs on the whole skin of this red heifer, or it's disqualified. And the Mishnah really went into detail about that. And all kinds of mysticism and traditions arose about the red heifer. And then the Mishnah says that the ashes of the first red heifer lasted all the way until the Babylonian exile. Well, that was a long time. So then they killed another red heifer, and it lasted, and it was Ezra that took care of the second one. And Ezra's and five more, they went through until the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So in other words, the Mishnah says there were seven red heifers that went from the time of Moses until the temple was destroyed. Now, here's where it gets interesting and where Christians today often hear about the red heifer. Some people believe that in order for Israel to have sacrifices again, they can only do it if they can find the ashes of the red heifer. Because you need priests who are spiritually cleansed or ceremonially cleansed in order to handle the sacrifices at the temple. And there are some people that believe that that can only be done if you find the ashes of the red heifer. Now, Christians get involved in this because if you come from the pre-millennial viewpoint, as we do, and the viewpoint of the kingdom is literal, and before the kingdom there's going to be a tribulation, and during the tribulation there's going to be the temple rebuilt, and there's going to be sacrifices offered at the temple because there's prophecy that talks about the Antichrist is going to stop the sacrifices that have been going on. So we believe that there will be another temple built in Jerusalem, and there will be sacrifices there, and all this is going to be before Christ comes again. So some Christians have really gotten into this about the red heifer. So you have a few branches of Orthodox Jews that are really worked up about the red heifer, and you have some Christians who are worked up about the red heifer. I read an article today, or yesterday, that I'd put in my numbers file. I have files of all the books of the Bible. When I find things that relate to different passages, I put them in those files and so on. So I looked up today to see what I had in my numbers file on the red heifer. I had a great article that appeared in 1998 in a good, reputable magazine. And this article said that the archaeologist who was kind of the inspiration for the character Indiana Jones, who of course is a fictional character, but the original book about Indiana Jones, it's fiction, but the author had in mind a particular archaeologist, that archaeologist is really into the whole red heifer thing. And he did some investigating with the Dead Sea Scrolls and became convinced that the Dead Sea Scrolls indicate that the ashes of the last red heifer are buried somewhere around the area of the Dead Sea Scrolls in Qumran in Israel. And at the time of this article was written in 1998. He had been searching for them for 8 years. I don't know if he's still searching today or not. I couldn't find that out. But anyway, you may have heard in hearing prophecy speakers, some speak about that we've got to either find the remaining ashes of the last red heifer, or we've got to find a red heifer that doesn't have a single black hair in it. And I've read articles of people have been trying to breed them in Scandinavia and then get one sent down to Israel. And several years ago in the Jerusalem Post, there was an article that a calf was born that seemed to be a perfect red heifer, and they're all excited about it. But then, sure enough, it grew a red hair and so on. So, but what I want to say, from what I have read, don't put a whole lot of stock in it. Even among the Orthodox, most or the Orthodox Jews do not believe you have to find the red heifer in order to start the sacrifices. In fact, the people, it's called the Jerusalem Institute in Jerusalem, that is getting things ready for building a new temple, and they've put together the furniture. They have priests ready to go and so on. They're the ones who are probably going to be involved when it finally happens. They do not believe that a red heifer is needed. So I took all that time on that because if you haven't run into it, who knows what's going to come up in the future about the red heifer. And I just urge you, don't get all worked up about it. That it's really not necessary. But it certainly was an interesting part of the rules that God gave here, especially when you see the reason for it. Now, the author of Hebrews mentions the red heifer in Hebrews chapter 9, verses 13 and 14, where in Hebrews 9, 13 and 14, he talks about the Old Testament sacrifices, and he says, "Those sacrifices, nor the ashes of a heifer, bring cleansing from sin." They are a picture in the Old Testament, but they have been fulfilled by Christ. So if the ashes ritually cleansed outwardly, the blood of Jesus does something that they cannot do, and that is it cleanses inwardly. It cleanses sin. Well, turning the page to page 15, we have B from Kadesh to Cana, or excuse me, Canaan, which is promise, chapters 21 to 36. And in chapters 21 to 25, we have the accounts of the serpent of brass that we've already talked about, and the story of Balaam. So let's talk about Balaam a little bit, since we've already talked about the serpent of brass. Balaam was a Gentile astrologer from Babylonia. There is reference to him in a couple of other places in the Old Testament, in addition to Numbers. And you look at all those references and you come to the conclusion that he was from Babylonia, not from Moab. This incident with Balaam occurs in Moab. If you look back on that map, two pages back, Moab is the area to the right of the Dead Sea that the Israelites came into in order to conquer the land. Now, the king of Moab is not very happy about 2 million foreigners walking across his property. And he wants to do everything he can, and he hasn't been able to defeat them in battle, and so he has another idea. He calls on this Babylonian astrologer, and he's a combination astrologer and sorcerer. Now, what a sorcerer did in those days was placed curses on a person. And the sorcerers were thought to really have powers with the gods. So the king of Moab, whose name was Balak, B-A-L-A-K, knows about this astrologer sorcerer named Balaam. He calls on him, thinking maybe he can get the God of Israel to put a curse on Israel. And if Israel is cursed, they're going to be destroyed and they're not going to be a problem to him. So he pays Balaam, and it pays him well to do this. Balaam agrees. Balaam, though, every time he opens his mouth, instead of a curse of Israel coming out, it's a blessing of Israel. What happens is God takes over the control of his mouth and is bringing these words out of Balaam. And then there's the incident with Balaam's donkey. That's the most famous part of the Balaam story. You remember Balaam's going along and he's not wanting to do what God wants and so on. And he's beating his donkey because the donkey just stops and just won't go any further. And then of all things, the donkey talks to him. Now, of course, non-believers say that's preposterous and so on. But it's not preposterous with God. There's no reason to believe that God didn't do that. And it's part of the events of what happened with Balaam. Well, Balaam, as I said, winds up giving Israel blessings, pronouncing blessings instead of curses. These blessings are prophecies from God of blessing to Israel. And one of the prophecies is messianic. And it happens to be in chapter 24, verse 17. And let's take a couple of minutes to read it, and then we'll close. Chapter 24, verse 17. I see him, Numbers 24, 17. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab. So King Balak, your people are going to be destroyed eventually by this king that's coming out of Israel and break down all the sons of Sheth. This is a prophecy of Messiah. It goes back to Genesis 49, when Jacob is giving the blessings on his 12 sons. And when he comes to the tribe of Judah, he says, Judah, the scepter is going to be with Judah. Scepter is the symbol of kingship, that the king, Messiah, is going to come out of the tribe of Judah. We have some addition now to that prophecy. In this verse, it tells us something about a star is going to come out. And so it's saying, and then the whole thing is saying, when Messiah comes, he's going to be a king. There's other prophecies that would prophesy of him being a prophet. And there's other prophecies that prophesy of him being a priest. And this is one that prophesies Messiah will be a king. Now, according to chapter 24, verse 25, when the story ends, Balaam goes home to Babylonia. And with him, he takes the prophecy of a star and the prophecy of a king connected with a star, a king of this people, Israel. This man is one of the forerunners of a group of people that are called the Magi. And you meet the Magi hundreds of years later in the book of Daniel. And that was a category of high up people under Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. And among other things, they studied the stars, just like Balaam did as an astrologer. And they had in their records a prophecy brought back by Balaam about a king and a star in Judah. And they looked for that to happen. Hundreds of years later, a king is born in Bethlehem, and there's a sign in the heavens. Looks like a star. Now, that's a whole study in itself, what it actually was. It appeared as a star. Bottom line is, I think it was the appearance of the Shekinah glory of God. And it looked bright like a star. Didn't act like a star, but it looked like a star. And the Magi, the descendants of this group of people, in this group of people of which Balaam was one of the forebearers, said, we got to go find that king. And it all goes back to Balaam in Numbers chapter 24. Well, wrapping up the book of Numbers, you have number two, the second census and laws of Israel. This census is for the purpose, because remember I said there's two numberings, that's why the book is called Numbers. Second numbering or census needs to establish the size of the tribes. Because when they get into the land, which is now about to happen, they need to know how much land does Reuben get and how much does Issachar and so on, kind of based on how many people. So they have a census. Then chapters 31 to 33, the concluding days of Moses' leadership, and chapter 34 to 36, preparation to enter the land of Canaan. So next week we go to Deuteronomy, where Israel is on the verge of entering into the promised land. And by the way, a great hymn of the church, Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah, is filled with references to the book of Numbers. So next time we sing that, kind of look for that in Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah. Well, good book to study, so much in it. I know it can look dry when you look at all those names and numbers, but there is so much more to it than that. Any prayer requests as we close?